Session number 11904, Lieutenant Commander H.J. Instance, Reel 1.
Mr. Instance, Reel 1. Can you tell me how you first came to serve on the Royal Oak, please?
Yes, I was drafted to the Royal Oak in June 1939. And we commissioned the Royal Oak in the good old-fashioned way that they used to commission capital ships. I think it was about the last one ever to do it. The whole draft, seamen, stokers, artificers, supply, cooks, we all mustered in the Royal Naval Barracks, Portsmouth, and all our bags and hammocks were put into four or five lorries, and we lined up in fours, with the seamen leading, and we were marched all the way from the Royal Naval Barracks to the farewell jetty in the dockyard behind the Royal Marine Band, right down Queen Street with lots of Portsmouth people all waving their hands because we were commissioning the Royal Oak to do a 2.5 year commission in the Mediterranean. We got to the dockyard, we were halted alongside the ship and turned to face the ship, and the commander came out on the little sort of bandstand they had and told us what a fine ship it was, and it had the reputation of being the cleanest ship in the Navy, and he expected it to remain so. And we all thought, oh dear. And then we all got our stations and we all picked up our bags and hammocks, marched up the gangway, and at the top of the gangway we were met by a regulating petty officer and a divisional officer, and you were given a card on which you had your action station, your defence station, your cruising station, your cleaning station, the mess you were going to and the part of ship you belonged to. And so you went down and you found your mess and stowed your hammock and the hammock netting, found your locker, steel locker, started unpacking your bag, and about half an hour later they cleared lower deck on the quarter deck, and then you were spoken to by the captain.
Was it the cleanest ship in the Navy, do you think?
Well, it's a big thing to say. She was a very clean ship, very clean. It may well have been the cleanest ship, I suppose.
Did that mean the absence of vermin?
Oh, no, no. Clean in the way of spotless decks, spotless paintwork, brasswork, all lovely and shiny, that sort of thing.
Were there any vermin on it?
Well, I think most ships have got vermin, cockroaches. And I can't say I've ever seen a rat, but then I haven't been down the bilges anyway. But most ships had cockroaches, that sort of thing, but you have to bear with that.
Did it bother you much?
No, not really.
Can you tell me about the crew, about their backgrounds?
Well, they were mainly, I suppose, 50% were all Portsmouth people, or the area around Portsmouth. And then, of course, we had people from Manchester, Newcastle, Liverpool, a few Scotch chaps thrown in. But she was a Portsmouth ship, and I suppose one could say 50% of the crew were from either Portsmouth or surrounding areas like Havant, Fareham, Petersfield, that sort of thing.
And the officers and the captain?
The captain's name was Ben. If I remember rightly, I think the commander's name was Nichols. And the officers were already on board the ship. They had joined the ship before the whole main crew joined the ship. So they were all there, you see. It was just a question of getting to know who was your divisional officer, who was the gunnery officer, who was the boatswain, the shipwright officer, and you did that in your, what they called your working up program. We sailed the next day, actually, for Portland, which was one of the bases for ships to work up. You had what you termed a working up period. You couldn't join the main fleet until you were of a sufficient high standard of efficiency. And it usually took a big ship, like a battleship, usually took 6 weeks. And in that 6 weeks, you fired every gun in the ship. You did all your evolutions, collision stations, everything that needed to bring a ship up to 100% fighting efficiency. And then you were inspected by the local admiral of the port, in which you did all the drills in front of him, and you were then passed fit to go and join the Mediterranean fleet. But of course we never got to the Mediterranean. We did our 6 weeks at Portland, and much to everybody's surprise, although not to a lot of us, because we all realised there was some sort of conflict coming, we had to paint dark grey all over, and our next stop was Scapa Flow, where we joined the remainder of the, what was then the home fleet.
About when would you have reached Scapa Flow, do you think?
At the end of August, beginning of September, something like that.
So before war was declared?
Oh, yes, yes.
Had you anticipated that war was going to be declared at that time?
I think most thinking men, although we were only young, I mean, I was only 23 at the time, but nevertheless, if you'd thought about it and kept your eyes on the paper and that sort of thing, you realised that it was quite a possibility there was going to be a war.
Did you hear war declared?
Yes.
Can you describe the circumstances under which you heard it?
I think it was in the morning, I think. We were told that there was going to be a broadcast, which was going to be broadcast throughout the ship. And so we packed up work and we all went down to our messes. And then over the tannoy system, which we had, we got the message that Chamberlain had said that he'd received no answer to his ultimatum, and so we were in a state of war with Germany.
What was your reaction?
Well, mixed feelings. There was a certain feeling of, right, let's show them like we did last time. And there was also a feeling of, I wonder what the hell's going to happen. We all knew that the German fleet, or some of the units, would try to break out into the Atlantic to damage our convoys, and we knew that we would be in and out of Scapa Flow whenever a warning came that a German capital ship was at sea. And if I remember rightly, we went out twice with an escort of four destroyers to chase some phantom German ship. We never actually crossed anybody's path. And it was then that we came back to Scapa Flow. And about a week before the tragedy, we'd had several reconnaissance, German reconnaissance aircraft over. And Admiral Forbes was a little bit worried that the fleet might be in danger from air attacks. No thought, of course, was given to submarines possibly even thinking of entering the flow. Most sailors thought, you know, whenever you were at sea on patrol or what have you, once you got through the boom at Scapa Flow, you were home and dry. And that was it. You could relax. But Admiral Forbes, about 2 days before the tragedy, he took the whole fleet out from Scapa Flow, right round Scotland to Loch Hugh, which was also a big anchorage, but it was out of range of the German bombers. The Royal Oak at that time had a slight fault in its machinery, and we could only do about 19 knots. And Admiral Forbes wanted to move the fleet at about 24, 25 knots. So he instructed the captain, or the admiral, because we had admiral on board, we were a flagship of the 2nd Battle Squadron, to stay in Scapa Flow, more up towards Kirkwall, as an AA guard for Kirkwall, and I think there was a couple of oilers that were laying about 2 or 3 miles away. And the sole purpose of us being there was One, because we couldn't keep up with the fleet, but the second main reason was an AA defence for Kirk War, because the AA defences around Scapa Flow had not been completed at that time.
Can you say something about your own job aboard ship? What kind of duties you had on the Royal Oak?
At that time I had passed professionally for warrant officer, and I'd also passed educationally for warrant officer. And although I was only a leading seaman, those qualifications were on my papers. And when I joined the Royal Oak, I was made my sort of cleaning station was leading hand in charge of the poop deck, which is a small deck just above the quarter deck. And I'd only been on the board the ship about a week, and the schoolmaster, the lieutenant schoolmaster, called me into his office and said, I see it by your papers you are qualified for warrant officer, having done the HET five subjects. So I said yes. He said, right, I want you to be my assistant schoolmaster. Well, that was a marvellous job, because I got ninepence a day extra for being assistant schoolmaster, and my job during the day, apart from cleaning stations and defence stations and action stations and so on, was teaching some of the lower level of boys. We had about 120 boys on board. Some were what they call advanced class boys, and the schoolmaster used to take those. But then you had what was known as the general service boys, and their education was just primary council school standard. And I used to have to take them in a little room just under the quarter deck in maths, English, and sort of general knowledge and geography.
Did you like doing it?
Oh, yes, I enjoyed it. And another duty attached to me purely because of this was I was also made librarian.
What were the relations like on the Royal Oak between the officers and the men, the ratings?
Not like they are today, of course. It was still the, you know, us and them, officers from Dartmouth and so on. You were just the crew, you see. But I didn't find any friction at all. In fact, my divisional officer, Lieutenant Hall, was a very, very nice officer indeed.
Was it a happy ship?
Not as happy as some ships I have been on. But then we'd only been in commission, 5 months, you see. We really hadn't settled down to a normal 2.5 year commission. It takes a little time for a ship to gel, you know, for the whole crew and the officers to gel together for you to say whether it's the happiest ship we've been on or whether it's a miserable one and you can't wait to get off it.
Had there been any unpleasant or upsetting incidents in your recollection?
Oh, no. No, nothing like that. The only funny thing, if you want something humorous, I gave the boys a composition to do one day on commissioning a Royal Naval ship, so that they could write about how they were marched down and given their cards and so on, and then any reactions to being on the ship. And I took these essays down to the mess during the lunch hour, and I had I was in charge of a mess of about 18 young men, but there was also another leading seaman in the mess. He was a PTI, and he used to take the boys to PE and the ship's company as well. And I said I read through these, and one of these copies had said, I like my gunnery instructor, and the seamanship instructor is very nice, but the PTI is a bastard. So I took it down the mess, and I gave him this copy, and I said, you're not liked very much, are you? So he read it, you see, and he said, oh, I'm not having this. He said, who is it? And the chap hadn't put his name on the paper. So I said, oh, come on. I said, I'll get him to write out 100 times that you had a mother and father. Oh, no, that didn't satisfy him. He wanted to see the officer watch and the commander. But we didn't know who it was. I knew who it was by his writing, but I wasn't going to let on. So I was sent for by the schoolmaster, and he said, right, give them all a piece of dictation, he said, and then we'll compare writing. Of course, they finally pinpoint this boy. And he was taken up before the commander, and the commander said to him, I can understand you calling the PTI a bastard. He said, because sometimes we say things before we even think them. He said, but when you write it, he said, you're thinking of it before you've written it. 10 days, 16.
You said that you've been on happier ships. Which was your favourite ship from that point of view?
I think my small ships were. Small ships were invariably happy ships, destroyers and sloops. You had a much, much closer contact with your officers. And, of course, a crew of about 100 or 120, you know, within a few weeks you know everybody. In a battleship with, 1,400 men on board, it takes an awful long time. In fact, sometimes you don't even know half the crew because they're stokers down below and you hardly ever meet them.
Can we go on now to the sinking of the Royal Oak in October 1939, and can you tell me in detail, step by step, as much as what you remember of it, please? Mm.
Well, everybody thought Scapa Flow was immune and so well protected that a submarine wouldn't even attempt to try and enter. There had been two that entered or tried to enter during the First World War, and both were sunk by static mines. But in this case, there was a gap. As you know, Scapa Flow is a collection of large and small islands enclosing a very large anchorage. And those gaps between the islands had been blocked with block ships from the First World War. But there was one place near an island called Hoy, where there were two block ships, but they didn't completely block the entrance. But the powers that be said, well, the water's too shallow. A submarine couldn't possibly get in here submerged. And so, although they were going to send up some more block ships, they didn't do, there was no hurry to do anything about it. Well, where this information came from to guide the German submarine, nobody seems to know. There was some talk about a watchmaker in Kirk Wall that gave him the information. But there was enough room for a submarine to get in between these two islands at spring high tides on the surface. And spring high tide on October the 13th, which was the Friday, was about somewhere between 12 o'clock and 12:30 at night. And Preen knew this, and he made for that gap on the surface, of course pitch black, and these islands are uninhabited except for a few sheep, and he came in and he edged his way around and under the wire of one of the block ships and got into the flow actually on the surface. When he got into the flow, of course, in deeper water, he submerged. And these reconnaissance planes we'd had over the week before had sent back or taken back photographs showing the whole of the home fleet in the lower end of Scapa Flow. Ships like the Renown, the Hood, the Ark Royal, the Repulse, numerous cruisers and destroyers. And he made straight for that anchorage. And of course, when he got there and came to periscope depth, there was nothing there. And so he then edged northwards up towards Kirk Wall. And there in front of him, of course, at odd times, silhouetted against the curtain of light you get in those high latitudes, Aurora Borealis, there was the outline, dim outline of the Royal Oak. And about a mile away was another small ship, a seaplane carrier called the Pegasus, or Pegasus. And he thought that that was the Renown. So he got into firing position and he fired four torpedoes. And then he went to the bottom, hoping to hear the explosions and then get the hell out of it. But there was only one explosion, because the three of the torpedoes he fired missed the ship forward. And the last one, fourth one, hit right down at the foot of the bow. Now, in those old battleships, you had what they called a ramming bow. The bow came down, and underwater it bulged out like that, and it was full of concrete. That, you know, it was going back to the old days of ramming. And that's where the torpedo hit. Well, this was the day previously. A lot of my young messmates were saying, here, rookie, it's Friday the 13th. Something's bound to happen today. And I said, oh, come on, don't talk nonsense. That's an old wives' tale. And this explosion shook the ship from end to end, woke everybody up, and I immediately hopped out of my hammock and I went to the next bulkhead, which was the boys' mess, because I knew there was a clock there, and it was 1:04. So I went back into the mess and I said, well, come on, I said, it's Saturday the 14th. I said, it's not the 13th, Friday the 13th. But I suggest you get out of your hammocks, get dressed until we find out what's going on. Well, most of them sort of looked over their hammock and said, oh, I'm going to stay where I am. But being leading out of the mess, I thought it was my duty to try and find out what was going on. So I dressed. I put my trousers and service jersey on, which saved my life eventually. And I saw the captain and the admiral and the commander go through our mess decks forward. I suppose they were going to try and find out what it was all about. So I waited around and nobody came back, and I heard one pipe, which was magazine crews take magazine temperatures, which was an understandable thing to do because we weren't sure what it was. As I say, a submarine was just out of the question. And then I decided to go aft, wander through the ship, go aft and see if I could find anything out. And I wandered along the starboard battery, and just at the end, of the port battery, just at the end of the port battery, was a small heads, or toilet. Normally the toilets are right up forward, but the Royal Marines are always messed, or used to be, always messed between the ship's company and the officers. This is an old tradition. And their mess was just about two decks below the 6-inch casemate, or 6-inch battery. And to prevent the Royal Marines during the night having to walk the whole length of the ship to go to the heads, they built a small heads just at the top of the hatch where their mess was. There were three sort of tills and a curved screen. And there was a queue there. So I thought, oh, well, I just as well join the queue. And we were chatting amongst ourselves about what we thought it was. And I heard somebody say, oh, I think it's one of the compressors blown up in the forward refrigerator compartment. But as I say, nobody knew. I personally thought it was a high-flying bomber that had dropped a bomb that had dropped somewhere near the ship. Anyway, when my turn came, I went in with this other young sailor who was there with me. He was in just a shift of clothing, just a pair of shorts and a singlet. And we were doing our necessary. And we were just buttoning up to come out when there was another enormous explosion. And about 3 or 4 seconds later, there was another one, much closer. And about 3 or 4 seconds after that, there was an enormous explosion right underneath where we were. And, of course, we really didn't have time to say anything. And I suppose a couple of seconds went by, and the ship shook. And all of a sudden, up through this hatchway, came this orange flame. It was like a blast of orange flame. And it hit this chap in front of me, and he went up like a match, just like striking a match. It flung me right back inside this little head, and because of the curved screen, it was going round and round inside. And of course, the other part of the flame had gone straight up through the battery and, you know, incinerated anybody up there. And all I could do was to huddle in the corner and cover my eyes and head, and then I could feel the skin bubbling up on my neck, and I was trying to cover my neck, and then I thought of my eyes again, and I was trying to cover everything, but of course you couldn't. And how long it went on, I don't know, 10, 15 seconds, something like that, maybe more. But all of a sudden it stopped, and it was pitch dark. All the lights had gone, two explosions previously had thrown the generators right off, and the ship was in complete darkness. And I went unconscious for about 5 minutes, I think. And when I came round, I realised where I was, and I tried to stand up and I couldn't, and I thought, I don't know what's going on, but I've got to get out. And I crawled out of this toilet, and this is where my memory served me very, very well indeed. As an ordinary seaman and an able seaman, I'd spent 2 years on HMS Resolution in the Med Fleet, and I knew the inside of that ship backwards. And I crawled out from this toilet. I crawled across from the port side to the starboard side, and I went down the starboard passage to where I knew the starboard screen door was, leading onto the quarterdeck. And fortunately, the door hadn't been bolted and barred and clipped. It was just a blackout curtain, Hessian blackout curtain. And when I got to the door, frame of the door, I started to pull myself up, and I suddenly realised then that I hadn't been crawling on the deck in the last 20 yards or so. I'd been crawling on the bulkhead, because she was over by about 60 degrees. And I looked out, pulled this curtain back, looked out, and I could see the quarterdeck at an angle of about 60 degrees, and I thought, oh my God, I've got to get out of this. So I stepped out onto the quarterdeck, and of course I went straight up on my backside. I split my head open where I hit the deck, and I slid straight down, and the only thing that stopped me, of course, was the guardrails. One guardrail caught me under the throat, and the other one caught me on the stomach. And I still wasn't really round. All I knew was that I'd been badly burned, and that she was going over, and I had to do something about it. And there was a midshipman next to me, hanging on the guardrails. Still had his, he must have been midshipman of the watch. He still had his telescope under his arm. And I don't know who he thought I was in the dark, but he said, do you think we should abandon ship, sir? And before I could answer him, the guardrails went under the water. And of course we got hit. We floated off and we got hit by this terribly cold water. I think it was about 40 degrees, 38, 30, 40 degrees, something like that. And this brought me round, sort of shook me out of my torpor. And I laid on my back like that. And I looked up, and to my horror, I saw the muzzles of two 15-inch guns coming down on, slowly coming down on top of me. And what had happened was, as the ship went over like that, the locking bolts of the turrets, which weighed about 300 tons, had sheared. It just had sheared its locking bolt, and the turret swung like that. You see? And there were the muzzles of the two 15-inch guns coming down on top of me. And I thought, oh my God, I've got to get out of this. And I turned round and I swam the quickest 100 yards I've swum in my life until I was exhausted. And then I turned on my back, and I knew I was clear of the ship then. And I turned on my back, and against the night sky, I could see the whole of the bottom of the ship as she was going over. And the noise was terrific. It was... The only thing I can describe it is to say it's like having a large biscuit tin full of nuts and bolts, and you turn it upside down.